The Half-Guarded Hour is recorded before a live studio audience. Say that like I've started. Actually, fuck it. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Half Guarded Hour at HalfGuarded.com. I'm here along with Will Cooling. We're going to be discussing Brexit. It's not just the most important meal of the day, and that's the worst joke. I'm sure it's been made 1,000 times, but I'm going with it. Will, how are you?
I'm very well, Mike. Thanks for having me on. I'm always good to talk about Brexit and also Remain, because there's no word that can't be improved by adding BR to it. Isn't that right, Mike?
I didn't know that there was a Bremain. Huh. That's pretty good, actually. I would have called them the Grumain, because they're more like GRs, but I guess, I don't know. Remain. All right. Anyways, being a man from the United Kingdom, England, you know, whatever, whichever term you guys are using this week, because you have so many of them for the same fucking, you know, island. I presume you're an expert on all things England trying to leave the European Union. So let's just start off. What is Brexit? What's going on? And what is going to happen in 2 days?
So we have a referendum on Thursday where all adults can go and vote whether Britain should leave the European Union. And what you said is kind of wrong, but kind of right, because it is basically, does England drag the rest of Britain out of the European Union? Our trusty Welsh sidekicks will probably vote the same way we do, but Scotland and Northern Ireland will almost certainly vote overwhelmingly to stay in the United Kingdom, and it's just whether England goes so decisively for leave that we drag the poor Scots and Northern Irish out with us.
Actually, you know, it's funny you say that, because that was one of the first things that came to mind. Because I look at this and I juxtapose it in somewhat ironic terms with the whole Scottish campaign, whether the Scots were going to leave. And it's like you had all these people in Scotland that wanted to leave England. And it seems like the same people that wanted to keep Scotland part of England want England to leave Europe.
There's a nice Venn diagram where that happens. I mean, yeah, the Scottish I mentioned, and it's also the opposite way around, because we've had this bizarre thing of Nicola Sturgeon, who's Scottish First Minister, a prominent independence campaigner, sharing a platform with English unionist politicians to advocate for Britain staying in the European Union. So the whole thing's kind of odd at the moment. For Scotland is more pro-European than England. I mean, that's partly due to history, because you know, the old alliance between Scotland and France, stuff like that. It's also because Scotland's a type of nation that the European Union was invented for. The reality is, until recently, the idea of Scotland being independent would be silly. You know, they were kind of too small, too sparsely populated, too hard to defend. To be independent, you know, it made more sense to pool sovereignty with England. Whereas now, with the European Union takes care of defence, it takes care of having your own currency, it takes care of your trade policy, your embassies. You know, if your country is Scotland, or even smaller countries such as Luxembourg, or Slovenia, or Latvia, or Estonia, you can now kind of be independent, but kind of not be independent. So, yes, the Scottish dimension for Brexit is very weird, and it has created some awfully odd bedfellows. Oh, I can't hear you, Mike. Still can't hear you.
How about now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah, I'm getting a new microphone, everybody, so just bear with me. Is Scotland also voting then on Thursday simultaneously whether they're going to stay or go?
Yeah, so basically the way it works is it's the whole United Kingdom in one go. So all four nations of the UK vote, and it's not separate, it's not like electoral college or anything like that. It is literally which side gets the most votes wins. So if, as is likely, Scotland and Northern Ireland vote remain by quite big margins, doesn't matter. If England, which, you know, people forget this, I mean, we can talk about Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, but they're tiny in comparison with England. I mean, Britain as a country has about 60 million people, of those 60 million people, 50 million live in England. It's by far the largest part of the United Kingdom. Unless it's very, very tight, whichever way England goes will be the way the country as a whole goes. So, it's very possible England drags Scotland and Northern Ireland out of the European Union. And the thing with Northern Ireland, because Northern Ireland's the one part of the UK that has a land border with the European Union, a land border that a lot of people have died and fought over, that raises a whole other set of issues, because you might then get border checks at the Northern Irish border again, which would not go down well at all with the Northern Irish.
So it's possible, I guess, that this whole Brexit thing may finally unify the six counties or whatever the hell it is and bring Northern Ireland back with the rest of Ireland and become one united shithole of a country no one goes to. Probably not.
I suppose in theory it is, but you know the whole joke about Germany. So when the Cold War ended, Berlin Wall came down, East Germany unified with West Germany. It was like the worst thing that ever happened to West Germany. Germany had an awful 90s because they had this very poor part of Germany that they were trying to desperately integrate into their country, and it took them a lot of money. It's still not working. You know, massive unemployment in Germany. The reason why the Germans can never get a government formed without the two major parties, their equivalents of Republicans and Democrats, keep going into coalition is because basically East Germany now keeps electing the communists about 20-25% of the East German vote, which means you can't get a majority in the German parliament. And the Republic is scared of that happening to them. It's not so much Northern Ireland is poorer than the Republic. It's just that a lot of the strategies the British government has done to keep the peace in Northern Ireland has made it very inefficient. Public sector is very very large by comparisons to most Western European countries. The trade union movement hasn't been challenged. So there's a one area where there's a lack of sectarianism. And of course, there's an awful lot of money spent on security. And you have no-go areas where gangsters have been allowed to rule areas of the country because they were the loyalist or Republican paramilitary strongholds. So Republic doesn't want it. They don't want that. They don't want the expense because it's affordable for Britain to have that expense. The Republic would struggle. And there's just a simple fact that most Northern Irish people don't want to be part of the Republic.
Yeah.
You have your 55% Protestants. You then have about 20% Catholic loyalists as well. I mean, most opinion polls show that if there was a referendum, it'd probably be about 70% to remain in Britain and Northern Ireland. You know, when you've been a part, I mean, what? So Northern Ireland has now existed for just coming up to 100 years. 100 years away, over time, this becomes a settled fact. You do diverge. I mean, it's hilarious. Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, the two leaders of Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland, have actually tried to win office in the Republic. And you know what people in Southern Ireland say?
I can only
imagine.
Why
are these people from Northern Ireland coming here? Why are these people from Northern Ireland coming here trying to win our country? After a while, a border just becomes a real fact.
Ah, fantastic! What a wonderful little fucked up scenario you guys have created over there with 13 different countries all under the same banner. And if I guarantee you, you ask your average American, are England and Scotland different countries? They would go, well, yeah, of course. Like, they have their own football teams. They're named differently, and yet somehow you guys get to control them and rule them and tell them what to do.
Well, I mean, you have this with UFC, which obviously we both follow, which is after the UFC's done X number of shows in Britain, it's like, the UFC's debut in Scotland is in this year. And it's like, well, yeah, I guess so. That's kind of like saying the UFC's debut in, you know, I don't know, Cleveland or, you know, just, you know, I mean, you know, Scotland has less people in it than London. The entirety of Scotland has less people in it than London. I mean, it's not as bad as some American states, which have, you know,
nobody,
more sand dunes than people. But Scotland's a very sparsely populated place.
Hey, but so, they're doing their part with heroin, though. They're keeping that trade going. We all know that, because I saw Train Spotting, and that's exactly what it's like. So, anyways, let's just get back to Brexit itself, because I know that's what the people really care about. I actually did study in Europe for a summer during law school, and surprisingly enough, I studied French law, civil law, and European Union law. So we got a little bit of a background. I was doing a little bit of my research and stuff, i.e. I was fucking around today at work. And it's kind of surprised me to see that the early adopters of England joining what is now called the EU, it was back then just, I think, the EEC, were basically the right wing. Especially Margaret Thatcher really came into power kind of in 84, I think it was, on a strong referendum of, no, we're going to stay part of this. And it seems like that's almost like, you know, again, now you have like UKIP, who I would think would be kind of the spiritual successors in many ways to Margaret Thatcher, and they're the ones pushing to leave the European Union.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, there's a broader point, and then we can talk about the details. The thing you have to realize about the European Union, and for those who are American and don't know what the European Union is, it's a federation of 28 nations. You know, it is literally all of Europe, except Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, Albania, former Yugoslavia. And if you really want to count Turkey, I guess you can say Turkey as well. And that is a big issue, which we'll talk about later. And one of the things you need to have to manage a relationship with 28 nations, and it's a lot of coordination, you know, same trade policy, same industrial policy, same as a coordinated approach to workers' rights, a coordinated approach to taxes in some areas, you know, a single area of movement. So I, as somebody in Britain, could move to France and they can't do a single thing about it until I've been there 6 months, not doing anything. if I want to bring my family, I can do that. I can even vote in their local, not national, but I can vote in their local elections. So it's a big, I mean, I think sometimes Americans get confused and they think it's a bit like NAFTA. It's not. It's a lot more than that.
Yeah.
So, to manage.
Well, what I was going to say is, for Americans, by way of analogy, from what I always kind of saw, the European Union is in many respects, it kind of mimics the early formation of the United States, where every state was kind of separate. They all had their own deal, but they came together for a unified currency and a unified defense, but they all kind of had their own laws. That's why you had some states had slaves, some didn't. So there was some degree of autonomy while recognizing the need for a greater unity, you know, for a public front with the world, if you will.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I mean, probably rather than the United States, but the original attempts at confederation are probably the best analogy if you're looking at an American example. But if you're going to try and manage the relationship between that many countries, the one thing you can't have is one country going in a drastically different direction. Like one country just waking up one day and saying, you know what, I don't like the way my life's heading at the moment. I'm having a bit of a midlife crisis. I'm going to just completely change everything about my economic policy, everything about my immigration. No, I'm just going to change the whole lot, and to hell with all my neighbours. I don't care what they think. And so what that means in all countries, not just Britain, is the radical parties dislike the European Union. Because as long as, if you're nice and centrist, if you're the European equivalent of a Hillary Clinton or a Mitt Romney, the European Union's fine. The European Union isn't going to stop you doing whatever you want to do. So all you want to do is slightly tweak the status quo. It's if you are...
Yes? Why have I lost you? This has never happened. I never lose somebody on the other end. Fucking Skype.
Yeah.
You are. Oh, okay.
That the European Union becomes a problem. So when we joined, the party in the country that was on the ascendancy was Labour's left, led by people like Tony Benn, And they just saw the European Union as this massive capitalist club that was going to stop them nationalizing everyone's, you know, hat and dog, and was going to stop them massively subsidizing industry, stop them charging tariffs. And the right thought, European Union's great. It's going to stop those guys doing that. Let's join. And so that's why you had the likes of Thatcher support EU membership. Days are slow on. So we joined in 73 under Ted Heath, who was Tory Prime Minister. We had a referendum in 75 because Labour came back in. And that said yes. What you then got throughout the 80s is Thatcher starts. There were a few slight issues in terms of how much money we spent. But once those are smoothed out, you know, Thatcher kind of got down business of trying to help make Europe work. And, you know, she pushed for a lot of liberalisation, the single market, which you hear a lot about, that's not just stopping European countries charging each other tariffs, whatever they import in, but actually starting to build a common regulatory framework. So if I build a car in Britain, I don't need to go through any regulatory hoops when I try and sell it to somebody in France. And I know the French government won't subsidize a car manufacturer in France that I'm competing with. But what then starts to happen is as the 80s go on, Thatcher becomes disillusioned because the EU is trying to bring in common standards on workers' rights, and is trying to coordinate more activities in spheres that she doesn't believe should be done on European level, such as foreign policy, such as law and order, such as a single currency. And that's what turns her against the European Union, is that she has her agenda. She's got as far as she can get. She no longer needs the European Union to implement her agenda. She's in charge of Britain. She wants to go further, and now the European Union is trying to say no. And that's when the right says, actually, we don't like this anymore. We want you to get out of our way. At the same time, the left is like, oh my God, these awful Tories want to take away our workers' rights, want to privatise everything, want to deregulate anything. Ah, the European Union will save us. We should back them. And so the whole cycle repeats itself. And if we ever got a hard left government in, you'd get the same thing. The hard left government would have 5 years. It'd get to a point where the EU would start trying to stop it. And then it would go against the EU, whereas the Tories would be thinking, oh, thank God the EU's protecting us. I mean, the fascinating thing with this thing is by accident we have a hardcore socialist in charge of the Labour Party. So we have Jeremy Corbyn, you know, this is the type of guy Bernie Sanders wishes the young people he's tricked to support him would let him be. And Jeremy Corbyn, deep down, hates the EU. But he leads a very pro-European party. And so he does give these rather odd hostage-style videos where he talks about the Labour Party's position rather than his own, and he'll be trotted out to make a positive case for the EU and spend four-fifths of it saying why the EU is so bad. So, yeah, no, it's... the fact that the Tories took us in and Labour was opposed, now it's the other way around, it's partly just because the EU is a great moderator and just stops governments do wacky things.
Which is not the worst thing, actually. It's kind of one of those deals where if everybody on the extreme of each side doesn't like something, it might be good or maybe the worst thing. I'm not really sure. I have Donald Trump maybe as being president, so I have no place to talk anymore because my country's going to hell. What do you think right now is spurring this current movement? Because I mean, there's always going to be that undercurrent of British nationalism. Oh, we want to be separate. Oh, we're better than, you know, Germany or whatever. But what is it? Why today? Like, why now is this movement seem to have picked up steam?
Okay. First of all, it's a huge fluke. So what happened was Tony Blair. I don't think Tony Blair kind of sits back and beats himself up about this. I'm sure he doesn't. He would just blame David Cameron and people being so mean. Tony Blair, when he came into power, made the decision that for the European Parliament, so the EU has its own parliament, which is a complete joke. There's no debate. It's just a load of people standing up in their own language, making boring speeches no one listens to, kind of like the Senate. he decided that Britain's election to European Parliament would stop being first past the post, which, you know, like we, like America, just have constituencies where, you know, whoever wins the most votes in that constituency gets a seat, and would come a version of proportional representation where the country is divided into super constituencies that elect several MEPs that better reflect the broad popularity of parties in the country. What that meant was is that the lock Labour, Tories and the Liberal Democrats had on the European Parliament representation was broken. And a small party called United Kingdom Independence Party that advocated withdrawal got seats on. It got a stronghold in Eastern England and the South West. And in 2004, and this will sound very familiar to you, it recruited a loudmouth reality TV show host.
No.
Which had dabbled in right-wing politics in the past, to be its lead candidate, and actually did even better, came second. Fell out with him. But then in 2009, as the next European elections are going ahead, it coincided with a huge scandal in British politics about them all fiddling their expenses. And so they did even better. And so now, as we get into 2010, for the first time in this rise of UKIP with a Tory government, you have the Tories forced into coalition with the Liberal Party. So you have the most Eurosceptic and the most pro-European parties in British politics in alliance. And you have this discontented, hard-right, Eurosceptic fringe in the Tory party, outside the government, the backbenchers, as we call them, MPs who don't have a government role. And they are making David Cameron's life live in hell. They keep putting votes down about how we need to have a referendum on Europe, how we need to cut the EU's budget, how the EU's being mean. And eventually David Cameron says, look, enough, enough, enough. If you're good for 2 years and don't cause me any problems, then you can have your referendum after I've got re-elected as Prime Minister. And so it's a massive holding operation. And what he says is, look, get elected. If it's a Tory government, I'll then be able to go to Brussels, have a renegotiation, improve our terms of membership, and see what we do. And the whole idea of this was to shut up his backbenchers and to deal with this threat from UKIP. Because what happened was, with the Tories in power, in coalition with Lib Dems, UKIP was starting to do extremely well, and there's a very real chance that not so much they'd win seats from the Tories, but they might take away enough Tory voters that Labour might win the seat if it was close. Huh. So we got this referendum on a fluke, and David Cameron did not want the referendum. He did the bare minimum renegotiation. He didn't get anything. No one talks about it now. So what we have is this weird situation where in our parliament, we have 658 MPs.
Oh, that's bad.
About 180 at most backers leaving the European Union. The rest are for staying in. So it's the most lopsided debate in Parliament ever. A slight majority of the Tory parties pretty much split down the middle, Labour's overwhelmingly, and all the other parties overwhelmingly in favour of staying in. In terms of the vote, there are lots of different reasons why you can want to leave the European Union. But the reality is the thing that the campaign has led on, and the thing that if they win, it'll be because, is the issue of immigration. Mm-hmm. Basically, until 2004, the European Union was a club of 15 states, of which 12 were quite similar. About 11 or 10 or 11 were quite similar. And so the Western European countries are similar levels of wealth, similar level of maturity of their economy, Yeah, people moved around, but not that much. You did have poor countries in terms of Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Greece.
Yeah.
parts of Italy, but there were a smaller proportion of the European Union as a whole, and a lot of money was chucked at them to try and make them wealthier. Also, no, with the exception of Ireland, these countries were quite isolationist. You know, Spain, Portugal, Greece, these are parts of Europe that people don't tend to leave until things got very bad recently. In 2004, you get the first wave of former Eastern European countries joining the European Union. You get 10 countries total. Get 10 countries in total, 8 from Eastern Europe. And Britain, along with Ireland, because Ireland has to, because we share immigration policies, and Sweden, I think, we opted not to impose transitional control. So basically, when you're full member of the European Union, as I said before, is that your citizens can go to anywhere within the European Union. But it's like, because these countries are a lot poorer and are probably going to get an increase in unemployment because all of a sudden their industries, their farms are going to be opened up to foreign competition from the rest of Europe, we'll give Western Europe seven years where they don't have to have freedom of movement, whereas we can make our investments in these countries in terms of foreign aid, development, infrastructure, pay dividends. Britain said no, and when I was doing some research, 2 years later, a Home Office minister said that in 2 years since Poland and the other seven Eastern European countries joined, 600,000 people from these countries had moved into Britain.
Holy shit.
And obviously some of them will have moved back, but this has just kept on going. And it's been a huge, huge movement. Britain was always likely to get a lot of people from these countries, particularly Poland, because we have links. I mean, where I grew up, had a big Polish community from the Second World War. But the scale of immigration into Britain took everybody by surprise. And what's happened is an awful lot, not all, a lot are skilled workers, but an awful lot have ended up in either unskilled or skilled manual work. And that has pissed off your working class voters and has led to a growth in anti-immigrant sentiments. Now, anti-immigrant sentiment was already rising in Britain because there had been an explosion of immigration from other parts of the world in the late 90s. But when you get this immigration from the EU, from the Eastern EU countries, on top of that, it becomes a really big deal. So, like, you look in 2005 when people are looking at focus groups, exit polls of why people have started to stop voting Labour. People thought it's going to be like, oh, it's going to be all these young, nice students annoyed about university being more expensive or the fact that we went to war in Iraq. It's like, no, it was a load of working class people saying, I'm annoyed that you're letting more immigrants in. You should stop it. And again in 2010, the same issue came up. You know, there was a famous incident of Gordon Brown being lectured by a lifelong Labour voter for letting too many immigrants in. And then when he thought she would, thought no one could hear, he called and go around and said, what, an awful woman, just a complete bigot.
Jeez.
And then in classic Sky News style, someone raced to find her and she played her the clip. She wasn't happy. And so there is now this impasse because you can't control immigration from the EU whilst you're in the EU. There is literally no limit. You know, anybody within the EU has a right to move anywhere else. And it's the only way you can do it because if you have complete free trade in an area, that is going to cause displacement. If say if I work I come from Loughborough. Say if I work in Loughborough, I'm a skilled plumber. No, I guess we say I'm skilled at making washing machines, but Krakow in Poland, they're the best at making washing machines in the whole EU.
Of course.
They're putting everybody out of business when it comes to making washing machines. My factory closes. Well, the obvious thing for me to do is go and move to Krakow, because that's where my skill is going to be most useful.
Right.
So you have this complete untrampled freedom of movement, but you have a population that wants controls on immigration, that does not want this sheer number of people coming into the country on a annual basis. Now, what politicians have tried to do is split the difference and get really, really draconian on all immigration from outside the European Union. And you know, really, it's really difficult if you're from outside the European Union to get leave to stay in Britain permanently now. But it's still not enough. You know, immigration into Britain, even now, is still approaching 300,000 every year, and that's net immigration.
Oh, come on. Now why have I lost you? I was just getting going. I know you'll come back. Nobody can hear you. They can hear me, I think. Fuck you, Skype. Well, oh, there you are.
Yeah. B.
Yeah, okay, you're good.
It will be a very odd coalition. It will be a sliver of Tories and then white working class voters, many of whom will have traditionally voted Labour. And after that, anarchy ensues.
I'm very curious, especially about the immigration issue, because I understand the free movement of peoples within the European Union. Again, kind of similar in the United States, if you want to move from Illinois to Wisconsin, you just do it. You don't have to get permission. But I don't know if this is how this works exactly, but particularly when I see with the Syrian refugee crisis, that I think it was Germany and some other countries were relaxing their standards for whom they would let into their country from outside, and once those individuals had relocated to Germany, they would then almost be free, I guess, to move throughout the EU. Is that right? Am I wrong? Is there anything like that?
Yeah. So I mean, that's less relevant to Britain. So basically, for us, there's freedom for Britain and Ireland, and I can explain why Ireland. And our trusty little sidecar. Britain and Ireland has freedom of movement, but we still have passport checks. Britain basically refused to basically, in the mid-90s, there was the Schengen area, which was basically to abolish all passport checks across the European Union. So the minute you got into European Union, the minute you passed the European Union border, you were there, and you could make a beeline from the English Channel to the Urals and never have your passport checked. Britain said no, and because we have a common travel area with Ireland, Ireland had to say no too, even though they didn't want to. What the Germans did, it's an incredibly irresponsible, idiotic thing Angela Merkel did, and it's going to cause Germany incredible trouble over the next generation, is she just overnight ripped open all European protocols on how we deal with refugees. European Union rules, Dublin Agreement, is refugees should be processed in the first European Union country they enter. Now, the problem with that is obviously there isn't a common European Union border force. The responsibility for policing the European, European Union's border is those countries that just happen to be on the periphery of the Schengen area. So that's particularly Spain, Italy, Greece, yeah. Croatia, Hungary, Bulgaria.
Turkey? And
we'll get to them. And Bedlam was in Syria. You know, you're having Hungary militarize their border. You know, you're having Viz having to police the Mediterranean and fish people out of the sea or not fish people out of the sea, depending on the policy was at the day. And yeah, Angela Merkel just said, we're going to take, you know, no matter where they are in Europe, no matter if they're in a refugee processing plant, wherever, they come to Germany, they can claim asylum. And it caused absolute chaos. It forced several countries to reimpose border checks. Schengen's probably dead. I mean, I think pretty much all of Europe, particularly after the attacks in Paris, pretty much all European countries are checking passports again now, to a certain extent.
Ah, shit.
But the problem is, it never made any sense, because it's the key thing, and this is where... So the European Union works on... It's basically a contract. So there was a genuine attempt to form a United States of Europe in the 1950s. So you have your initial... steel and coal community.
Oh, I knew that one.
The original idea of the European Union was France and Germany keep fighting each other, Italy sides with one of them, and then the Benelux countries provide a battleground. If we take these countries, steel and coal and iron off them, and put in the hands of this supranational impartial body, then you can't have any wars, because you can't fight without at that point you can't fight without steel and coal. They're kind of your building blocks. So that happens, and then in 1954 you have the attempt from the European political community, and that is the whole shebang. I mean, that is, you know, going from 0 to 60. You know, that's a parliament, that's a common. A common approach to foreign affairs, a common army, and it loses in France, because there's a referendum on the proposal to create a European army, and quite possibly the greatest, certainly in terms of what he managed on playing a weak hand well, one of the greatest statesmen of the 20th century, Charles de Gaulle, just led the campaign against this, and he has a very funny quote which I don't remember, making fun of the idea of a European army, and it's sort of like a French soldier fighting for a German commander, saluting an Italian flag to protect a Dutch village.
Yes, kind of true.
The idea that this just doesn't make any sense. You know, people fight for their country; they don't fight for other people. It's complete nonsense. And it lost. And so what's happened since is, the way the European Union works is, you secure agreement for some integration, and you wait a few years, and then by integrating an area of activity, you then create European-wide problems that need more integration. And then a few years later, that... integration and now created other pan-European problems, which needs more your European integration. Classic example of this is kind of what we were talking about earlier when talking about the switch from Labour opposing the European Union to Tories. So you have the election of all tariffs, so free trade across the European Union. But then you have some countries say, but this is unfair, because we used to use our tariffs to protect us from countries that massively subsidize their industries.
Right.
So now we're getting these countries dumping their stuff on us because they're subsidizing industries. Or we're having these countries stopping us from exporting to them because they have all these stupid regulations that we can't meet. And so then, to make free trade work, you have to have a common regulatory framework. So ban on state aid for companies and common approach to regulating trade. But then the workers are like, well, wait a minute, this is not fair, because if there's no tariffs and if the level of regulation is the same across the European Union, then it would make sense that everybody just goes to the country that promises to let businesses screw over their workers the most.
The race to the bottom.
Race to the bottom. Okay, well, then what we need is a social chapter that enshrines a minimum standard of worker regulations across the European Union. And so you see, this ratchet effect keeps going. And that's how the European Union works. And the reason European Union, for example, is in crisis at the moment is that's broken. Because the whole idea of the European Union, or the whole idea of the single currency, is not that there would never be a crisis. Is that there would be a crisis, and that would be the pretext for, say, a common tax policy, or common policies on public spending, or a common European budget. So you then have the wealth transfers that make the American currency zone work. And what happened was, and this is a fundamental weakness of the European Union, when that happened, Germans went to the Greeks, you're lazy, work harder. The Greeks went to the Germans, you're mean, you're fucking us up. The French went on strike, because they're the French.
they're on strike right now, I see.
They're strike right now. And the whole thing broke apart, because there is no such thing as European people in the same way there's the American people.
Right.
And, and that took 200 years. Now, you had identities that had existed for, 50, 100 years at most? I mean, when was Texas invented?
We just ignore them. But yeah, 18-something or whatever. But yeah.
Yeah. And it took a lot of time to fuse these into one set. And you have to fight a very bloody war. I mean, one of the great quirks of language, one of the very telling quirks of language, is that before the American Civil War, people would use to talk about the United States as a plural.
Yeah.
It'd be the United States. After the Civil War, the United States.
Exactly. Yeah. You know a lot more about America, I think, than I think a lot of most Americans do. That's very good.
But Europe, A, has not had a, well, it has had a lot of wars, but it hasn't had anything, had a war to keep it united. Well, actually, it's had many wars to keep it united, usually due to some madcap plan by a Frenchman or a German.
It's always a German. Let's just blame the Germans. They've been responsible lately. We all know.
But also, the identities are just a lot more established. I mean, look, England and France have existed in something approaching their current form for approaching 1,000 years. Spain isn't much younger. There have been German kingdoms. Germany can trace its history back to the end of the Roman Empire. Now, German kingdoms have existed for way over 500 years. It's going to be far more difficult to blend these countries together in anything that's coherent. And so what's happened is it's been this very undemocratic conspiracy of the elites. And so you just get governments meeting together, appointing unelected bureaucrats who work closely with big corporations to impose a, in many areas, perfectly sensible set of policies, but which is fundamentally lacks democratic legitimacy. And it means is that when a part of the European Union gets into trouble, they can't appeal to common solidarity. I mean, you imagine, Mike, in America, what would happen in America if there was a state that had 50% youth unemployment? I mean, what would the federal government do if it had gone so bad that state had 50% youth unemployment and, you literally had, former teachers, professors begging in the street?
It's almost unfathomable in a way, but we do it all the time in America. We bail out states when they get in debt. Illinois is so far in debt that we are basically our only hope for the future is we assume the federal government will bail out the state, because if they don't, we'll collapse, and we know that they'll bail us out because we just kind of take care of everyone.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of it is automatic. It's not even like you have to cut a check to Illinois. A lot of it will be, okay, say, actually, Florida and Nevada are the best examples. They have a massive housing boom that crashes. And actually, we can talk about the crash in a minute, but a lot of what happened to Mediterranean wasn't their fault. But there was a crash in Florida and Nevada, massive unemployment. But that's fine, because the federal government is the one who pays for unemployment benefit. The federal government is the one who pays for Medicaid. So as people come low income, the federal government puts the bill for their healthcare. If people leave those states for work, it's a taxpayer lost for those states. But it's no big deal because the money's in the same country. But what's happened with some of these countries is that, you know, they're having massive demand on their welfare states at the time that their tax revenues have just plummeted, and they have no way out of it. Because, say for Britain, the great advantage, the great lie of the past 6-7 years is the idea of poor Germany. Oh, poor Germany. The Greeks and the Italians and the Spanish keep asking them for money. It's like, no, fuck that. Germany has a great deal, and it's a great deal because these Mediterranean countries are doing so poorly. The idea of a single currency was something the Germans had been pushing since the late 70s. It only happened in the 90s. It wasn't a new idea. And the reason why the Germans wanted some form of single currency or some sort of system of fixed exchange rates is that a pattern was emerging in post-war Europe, which would be, Germany, ran its economy very well, would do very well, but the other countries, particularly the likes of Italy and Greece and Spain, but also including France, would do well for a bit, get into problems, and then announce that their currency would be 10%, 15% less in value. And by doing that, they then made their exports cheaper for other countries to buy, so undermining Germany's position in the export market, which a lot of their industry is focused on. And so Germany would have to then work twice as hard to regain its competitive edge. By the time they'd done that, those countries were in one of their next periodic crises, and so would announce another reduction in their currency, and Germany back at square one. So that's annoying at its most basic level, because they're like, well, we're playing by the rules. No, we're investing in our industry, we're running our industry well, we're making good things to export to people, but all these naughty people around us keep making their stuff cheaper by cheating, by just making our currency cheaper. What that also meant is it meant that German banks, which, because the German government doesn't borrow money like a sane government, and because German people save a lot, the German banks want to lend money, but they can't really risk lending money to a lot of European countries, because they know there's always going to be this danger that in 5 years' time they do a competitive devaluation, and what you've got as collateral or what you have lent will be worthless. So the European currency solves these problems and a third one. So it solves the problem of competitive devaluation by the fact that you can no longer devalue. So Germany and Greece have the same currency. So Greece, when it gets into economic problems, can't devalue. Because the German banks now know the Greeks can't devalue, they can lend money to the Greeks now. Because it's as if they're just lending money to a German company. So what you have when the single currency comes in is a massive flow of credit to Spain, Portugal, Greece, Italy, countries where that level of credit just had never been accessible before. Now, I've often used the analogy of a kid who's got his dad's credit card. Overnight, these countries got given a credit rating akin to Germany's, and it led to a boom in construction, you know, just all sorts of massive projects being funded by credit from Germany. And what it meant was, is these countries brought a lot more stuff from Germany, an awful lot of, you know, there were wage increases in these countries, there were no new consumer goods purchased. So what was happening is, these countries were becoming increasingly less competitive against Germany. Germany was coming cheaper compared to them. Crash comes, time they would normally devalue, they can't. They have to go through all this horrible stuff trying to do it by, you know, wage cuts, public sector cuts, privatizing things. It's absolutely horrible. But what should then have happened in this moment of chaos and great global uncertainty is that Germany's currency should have risen in value. I mean, you know, it's obviously American. You know, right. When there is global uncertainty, the dollar rises in value.
Mm-hmm.
And the German currency really should rise in value because the Germans their government is hardly borrowing anything. No, they literally are running, some quarters, they're actually running a surplus. But because the German currency is shared by a lot of basket case economies across the Mediterranean, the German currency, the euro, can't rise in value, which means that their exports are still competitive. The euro is this great money-making machine for Germany, and the rest of Europe, particularly the Mediterranean, is paying for it.
I've always wondered, because I always kind of had this working, not conspiracy theory, but just theory, that when what you're saying basically of Germany almost subsidizes some of these countries, and I've always kind of wondered how much of that was brought on by German guilt after World War II, like where they just said this is their way of making penance for the horrible evils that they did. And I would imagine at a certain point, you know, you get people my age or younger who are going to look back and go, I had nothing to do with that. I don't want to help out Greece because they're living on the sea and they have, you know, really nice weather, and I'm freezing in Germany with a bunch of Lutherans like my mom, and I'm tired of this shit.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely get the sense that Germany's in that transition period, and it's a bit of a nightmare, really, because it means that they're very erratic. You know, at some points they'll be incredibly domineering, and then they'll retreat back into their shell. I mean, the issue of the Mediterranean has been fundamentally, and when you read any of the stuff in the German press, or read translations, obviously I don't speak German, is fundamentally the Germans don't see these people as Europeans. They see them, I suppose, you know, the American term would be Hispanics. They are a second class of citizen. And so there's highly racialized attacks on why these countries are in this problem. And it is, you know, you're right, it's they're lazy. So one is, why do they have to have these siestas?
Like, well, yeah.
It's fucking hot, guys. It's all right talking about working 9 to 5 when you're stuck in Britain, France, or Germany. But if you're in the Mediterranean, it kind of makes more sense to kind of work for a few hours, have a siesta, then work later in the evening. That's just a much more rational way of ordering your day. And look, I'm not saying there's not a load of... I mean, in England, I don't know if this is the phrase in America. In England, we literally have the phrase Spanish practices for inefficient ways of working. So I'm not denying that doesn't exist, and you know, there had to be reform. But yeah, Germany did subsidize the European project out of guilt. A lot of that actually was given to the French to subsidize their farmers. And I think that really is changing now, and Germany is becoming more assertive. Well, and Greece has fallen above that because it from a German, I mean, Paul Krugman talks about this, and he's very good at it. The Germans just think of economics as a morality play, and they I mean, they mislearned some of the lessons of their own history. Hyperinflation wasn't the thing that brought Hitler to power. That's something of a myth. But they just think the Greeks in this situation, because they've been bad, and they just need to be more like the Germans. Which is something the Germans do happen to say an awful lot throughout the 20th century.
I was going to say, you would think that eventually Germany would learn them saying, everybody just needs to be like us. Well, the last time you guys did that, you almost brought the entire world to nuclear annihilation. So maybe you should back off that one a little bit there, Germany.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons why I've never been other reasons as well. Kind of more the old Labour reasons, but fundamentally, you know, European nations are just so different. And yeah, we can cooperate as neighbours and friends, but trying to fuse us into one block is just going to end up in tears. As you said, it's an argument even in America. It's ended up in tears because, you know.
Oh yes.
The anti-federalist made his point, which is just that big countries are more liable to be captured by vested interests, because the vested interests just have a critical mass that makes them very difficult to ignore. But it's also just that, what really does California have in common with Texas in reality? No, when you really get down to it, these are countries they've left. These are states that are big enough to be their own countries, and have left to their own devices, would pursue very different approaches to government.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, the other day I just saw that California passed France on the world's largest economy scale. Like, that's the size of certain some of our states, and it's like. And that's why I've always kind of been annoyed, at least in America, when people want to have national policies for things. And people, you know, if you say states' rights, it sounds racist because it was used by racists way back when to oppress black people. But I always think, if you're in Alaska, you're different than if you're in California, and you're different than if you're in Alabama. Like, none of those people have anything in common. And I would imagine it's the same thing as Germans have nothing in common with the Spanish. The Spanish live a life a different way. They enjoy their siestas. They're happy. They still work 8-9 hours a day. They just space it out. That's how they go about life, and they're fine with that. And the Germans, they wake up with their angry language, with their angry food, and their angry football team, and then they just work really hard, and that's just what they do for life.
Yeah, and it's the one thing about, obviously, because America has been a unified country, America's got specialization. So one of the problems you have in terms of treating Europe as a single country, you know, single economy even, is that people just don't move. People in Eastern Europe are into different parts of Western Europe. But Western Europeans just don't move. I mean, it's only very skilled workers or people who are desperate. And in Western Europe, they're willing to move, and that just means that you don't get the labour market flexibility that you do. Well, you used to. I mean, it's decreased in America as well, that you used to get in America. Going back to the immigration point, and the point, we keep saying we'll get to Turkey, and then not.
Well, let's do Turkey. Let's talk about Turkey. Are they actually European, or what? What the hell is Turkey?
Of course they're not European.
Well, I'm not going to say it. It sounds a little racist if I say it. But, yeah, they're all Muslims. But we can say it. It's fine.
They
have no common culture, no common history. They're just simply have never been historically part of Europe, ever.
I mean, Europe, the boundaries of Europe are defined by the historic boundaries of Western Christianity. I mean, that is just the fact. I mean, it's not like Australia or the Americas. You know, there is no reason to divide Europe from Asia. except the fact that that's where we've chosen to divide it due to history. You know, Siege of Vienna, that's, you know, that's the watershed of the Ottoman invasion, and then it's beaten back. And on the Urals, you have the border is usually where Orthodox Christianity is, was at its strongest. In terms of Turkey itself, I mean, Turkey itself has cooperated with European countries, throughout history, obviously, descendants of the Byzantine Empire. But in terms of its attempt to become part of the European Union, it first applied for membership in 1987, and the application's not going well. But the debate in Britain has been bizarre because Turkey will never join European Union because at least two countries, France and I want to say Croatia, have promised that if the government ever agreed that Turkey should join, they would give their people a referendum on Turkey joining. And we all, France, that would just be the most almighty no in history. I mean, you'd have to weigh the no votes rather than count them. And so we know it's not going to happen. But they have been negotiating. Turkey has been trying, until recently, has been trying to meet some of these criteria. And this process of Turkey trying to join is not a nothing thing. I mean, the whole history of Turkey since the end of the Ottoman Empire, and it was reformed in Kemal Atatürk, was that you had a secular army,
right?
And he remade Turkey as a more Western country. So, you know, Islam was banned from the public sphere. Women were not allowed to wear veils in public buildings. It used the Roman European alphabet.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe also that I think within, like, I'll call it the Turkish constitution, but basically if a crazy ever came into power, the Turkish army was basically told, get rid of the crazy guy and make sure that we have just a secular kind of, we'll call it mainstream normal government in place.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly that. And of course, European Union, you can't really have your army on standby ready to launch coups. That's kind of against the rules. So the European Union says you need to dismantle the hidden state. You need to dismantle the army's ability to launch these coups. And the army did that because the army kind of thought that joining the European Union would be a way of entrenching it in secularism. Unfortunately, by doing that, it meant that an actual Islamist party could come to power. And as things have gone further and further, but I mean, it's early days, it's only been 10 years, but I don't see Erdogan ever going willingly ever looks to the lecture. It kind of feels like in 15 years' time we're talking about Turkey as a Islamist dictatorship.
It does seem that Turkey has unfortunately moved away from modern Western values and is becoming more and more basically radicalized. Now, a lot of people don't want to say that, but the fact is that's just what's happening. They're having the Iranian, Saudi Arabian influences flowing into Turkey, and suddenly they aren't the Turkey of old where, you know, my mom could have walked around just fine. Now, I don't know if they're quite to the point where Western women have to wear a hijab, but they're getting a lot closer to that than they should be, and that is just so completely incompatible with Europe. I mean, you got like France and Germany. I mean, England still has a queen as a head of a church. Now, I granted, Europe's not all that Christian in a whole, but it's a hell of a lot closer to Christian/atheist than it is you know, fundamentalist Islam.
Well, no, I mean, I wouldn't say it's Turkey's movement. I just think it's Turkey not being artificially kept in a certain place. I mean, I think if you'd had free elections in Turkey at any point in recent history, you'd probably have got a government similar to what they've got now. It's that, it's just that thing of it's the old joke about Algeria, which is you know, in Algeria, democratic government is one man is one man, one vote once. Because if you'd have free elections, Muslim Brotherhood would win, and then there'd be no more elections.
I like that.
And so, when you stop the army overthrowing governments that broke the constitution, you're always going to have this gradual move. And again, it's not so much it's Syria, it's Saudi Arabia, Iran influence. It's that Turkey wants to be the big dome. I mean, Putin, you got to remember, before the First World War, Turkey was the dominant power throughout the Muslim world. And, you know, you certainly see with some of the stuff they're doing that they want to regain that. But it's certainly true that they're not following... No, just 10, 15 years ago, Turkey was Israel's staunchest ally. That would be completely inconceivable to say anything like that now. No, a sound ally of the West. And I'm not saying that Turkey should be should follow us on everything, because I think a lot of our policies are kind of odd. But you look at the double game they're playing in Syria and Iraq, I don't see how anyone can say Turkey is a sound ally. In terms of Europe and Islam, I mean, Europe does have sizable Muslim minority, particularly Britain and France. And again, it is one of these things that just shows how different countries are. Because, and ironically, actually, this came up in Canada, because obviously Canada has Anglophonic and Francophonic communities. So the French system is, we are secular. We are a republic of rules. Obviously, these rules are infused by France's traditional anti-clericalism. And so we will ban hijab, we will ban reflections of Christianity, of religion. We will not collect census information about religion. We will not make any attempt to reach out to Muslim communities. They must conform to the rules of the Republic. To ask the Republic to change for them would be wrong. Britain is different because Britain has never banned religion from the public sphere. It's always kind of had religion there. I mean, so whereas in France, the only religious schools are expensive private schools, in Britain, you know, the state has always been willing, well, since there's been public education, the state has always been willing to fund religious education. So in Britain, not just hijab, not just veils, full-blown burqa is not uncommon to see in the street. You know, Muslim schools are not uncommon. In fact, they're growing in number. That's fine. No, there's nothing wrong.
Inherently, there's nothing wrong.
Inherently, nothing wrong with Islam. All religions have their crazies. All religions have their moderates. As long as everyone knows the rules and sticks to them, it's all fine. Obviously, though, the issue is that there are people who don't agree with that. And this is where it comes back to your thing of, you say states' rights sounds racist because racists used it. And where we are with the Leave campaign I probably put it as, you don't have to be racist to vote Leave, but it certainly helps. and the other joke is, not everybody voting Leave is racist, but everyone who's racist is voting Leave. And I don't think that last one's quite true. I'm sure there are plenty of racists voting Remain, but it gets to a point. So one of the reasons we're having this referendum now is because the fear that when the weather gets warmer, you are going to have the restart of this migration crisis. And the country that is at the front line of that crisis is Turkey, because Turkey is a passageway through to the Balkans, through to Greece, through to the EU. And the Germans, because of this idiotic promise that Angela Merkel made last year to house all of Syria in Bonn, are desperately trying to get the Turks to act as Europe's border guard. It's a role that actually Gaddafi used to play before we decided to get rid of him because of an idiot decision of Sarkozy and Cameron. And that puts David Cameron in this awful position. So we know Turkey's not going to join because it'd be vetoed.
Right.
We know Turkey probably doesn't want to join because it's now got a Islamist government that's looking more to the Middle East. But we can't say no, because that would be rude. That would embarrass the Turkish government and may make them less likely to sign this big deal to help police Turkey's borders. And so you've got this awful thing of where you've got the Leave campaign attacking David Cameron for being weak on Turkey's proposed membership of the EU, scaring people at the idea Turkey's going to join the EU. You got David Cameron, who kind of can't say he doesn't support it, because that would be undiplomatic, kind of stammers out it's not going to happen, it'll never happen. The Leave campaign, then you say, but you went to Turkey 5 years ago, and you promised them it was going to happen, so are you lying now, or are you lying then? And so it's the most bizarre thing ever, because it's not going to happen, but Turkey is going to have a close relationship with the EU once this deal's written. Probably an increase in the number of visa-less permits to travel in the EU are given to Turks. So it's just made a very confused situation.
So we have a situation, in a sense, where a grown man who once had sex with a dead pig may be the moderate force keeping all of Europe together in some sort of weird crisis.
Well, this is a weird thing. I mean, the weird thing with Brexit is, whatever happens on Thursday, Brexit has kind of won. Because this isn't like Scotland. So in Scotland, you know, Britain had a near-death experience with Scotland leaving. Britain gives Scotland all these extra powers, and it's fine. Because Britain's not changing. It's not like Britain's going to want to take more powers away from Scotland, or it's going to have some great crisis with the Welsh that will need to completely change the way Britain runs.
You say that, but after Euro 2016, with the way that, you know, Gareth Bale's been playing, and all of a sudden England isn't going to win their group, I'm just waiting for them to you know, have retaliation against the Welsh. It might happen. Yeah, I watch a lot of football. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I got I'm still annoyed at it. I'm still annoyed.
Also, by the way, as an aside, how fucking creepy was that episode of Black Mirror? Like, what the fuck was that? Where did that come from? How did they have somebody, a PM, on Black Mirror having sex with a pig before Cameron did it? That can't be a coincidence. There's something weird going on.
It was. I mean, the author, when the story came out, was like, you can't imagine how weird the day I've had.
That's one of the best shows in the world, by the way. Oh my gosh.
That is. And also, that inspired a really good porn.
What?
Yeah.
No.
The porn parody of that. Not involved with it, obviously.
Okay. I just want to make sure that
to be fair, I'm sure there are other porn parodies that involve various female animals, but I haven't watched them.
Well, you know, I mean, different strokes for different folks. It's Europe. It gets a little freer than we are. Although, I wanted to get back to particularly the Muslim immigration into Britain.
Let me just finish your point.
Go ahead.
How Brexit won. Europe's not like that. Europe is a moving train. And Britain is already half out of the European Union. We weren't a member of Schengen, and maybe they get to resurrect that in a couple of years' time. We're not a member of the Euro, we never will be. And because we're not a member of the Euro, we're not in any of the decisions about trying to save the Euro from its own inherent contradictions. At some point, and we've opted out of various elements of the law and order, anti-crime stuff. Some point, the European Union will have more powers to help run the Euro more effectively, and we'll opt out of all of them again. And this is just going to keep going and keep going, because after this, you know, if it is 40, 45, maybe more, even if it's still, we still stay in, if you get that proportion of the country voting to leave the EU, no prime minister is going to be willing to suggest we give more powers to Brussels. They're just not going to do it. So you are going to get this divergence, and Britain just become this kind of awkward semi-detached member of the club.
Interesting. So that, having said that, because we are over an hour and Raw is on right now, not that I really give a shit. I wanted to ask, because I saw this the other day, and it was just kind of astonishing to me that in England, 52% of Muslims in England want homosexuality to be illegal. And I saw that, and there was like, I think it was 30%+ of Muslims in England thought that women should be subservient and obedient of their men. And I'm wondering, with the influx of immigrants, and clearly that to me shows that they're not assimilating, you know, English values. Because I imagine your regular English individual does not think that, you know, being gay should be a crime. Is there a real struggle? How is England dealing with that kind of push and pull, if you will?
It's weird. I mean, that the issue of Muslim immigration was a huge issue at the turn of the century, and we had actual race riots at the turn of the century in Northern England, but an awful lot of the attention has been more on this issue of Eastern European migration, and if you talk about the issue of integration, it's now more in the context of counterterrorism and the like. The issue, it's a very odd situation. So most Muslims in Britain don't come from countries that traditionally had a massive problem with hardline attitudes. Most Muslims in Britain are of Indian heritage, from India itself, from Pakistan, from Bangladesh, from Africa, from the West Indies. And what it's more about, it's not so much about immigration, it's more about people who are disconnected from society. That's how I'm going. So not overly hardline by standards of some of the Muslim communities. Obviously, you have all religiously devout groups. I mean, I'm sure you know, if you went to evangelical Christians in certain parts of America, you get similar responses. There is an issue with attitudes towards homosexuality and women. It's a nettle that isn't really grasped enough, in a sense of a lot of the people who are most in favour of multiculturalism, a multi-faith society, are also the ones most in favour of gay rights, women's rights.
Right.
And that tension is ignored. I don't think it's not one you can't solve, but it probably involves a lot of education, a lot of work to make sure women are given the same education opportunities as men, and also, and that a lot of that does go on. The bigger issue, I think, the thing I think that that dedicates more attention at the moment is young men, in the sense of, and obviously what happened in Orlando is a good example of this, where you get young men who are alienated, who are confused, who are angry, whose lives are spiraling out of control, and hardline Islam becomes a way of refuge. It becomes a way of imposing order and meaning on their lives and makes them do and encourages them to do horrific things in the same way that, you know, in some of the mass shootings we've seen that, you know, white supremacy or,
right.
Or evangelical Christianity can do the same thing. And I think that's the thing that worries people and how you handle that. And a lot of that is looking at, you know, breaking down educational disadvantages, economic disadvantages. A lot of work is done on what's called PREVENT, which is a government strategy to combat radicalization in the education system. And so government works with universities, works with schools, just to make sure that in terms of schools, it's what's being taught. And so there was a chain, ironically, wasn't it actually a Muslim faith school, it was a Church of England faith school, but because of its catchment area, basically became a de facto Muslim school, got into trouble. For what it was teaching and had all its governors removed. In universities, it's less about what's being taught, because universities, like in America, are incredibly male and pale. But it's more about what the Islamic society...
That's not actually true. In the United States and the United Kingdom, I think 55 to 60% of the people at university are now female.
The ones teaching.
Teaching. Well, I never paid attention to the teachers. I was looking around the classroom. Okay, yeah.
It's what the Islamic societies are doing, which is a question. So there's an awful lot of emphasis placed on that, and it's very controversial because, I mean, our National Union of Students, recently elected Marlia Bahua, who I actually knew at one point vaguely, who's quite strident. Anti-Zionist campaigner, and she's got into problems with some of the things she said in the past, and you know, she thinks prevents spying on Muslim students. So that's the real issue. But yeah, as I said, it's not as big an issue as you would think. I mean, again, between 2000-2005, the issue of Muslim immigration, maybe 2006, was a very high priority, how you'd integrate people, what that would involve. But I do think as the issues around Eastern European immigration has become more and more salient, that has kind of diminished. And again, what I have to remember is the issue of immigration from the quote-unquote the Muslim world is an issue in the past tense. It is very... If you're not from Europe now, it is very difficult to get into European Union. I'll give you an example. So a friend of mine at uni married somebody from Trinidad, and they now live in Trinidad. But they couldn't risk, even though they don't need it because they live in Trinidad, they couldn't risk her visa running out without being renewed, because if it ran out without being renewed, they would then be on the new system. So they had to come all the way back to the UK to renew her visa so she could still be on the process towards getting British citizenship. Because if it had lapsed, they had to go into the new immigration system. Not only would she need £20,000, he would also need £20,000 to act as her sponsor. To confirm that basically, if she came to live in the country, she wouldn't be a burden on the state?
Oh, no. No woman is worth that kind of money. I know that from experience. Oh, my gosh.
And this is when you talk about immigration, this is one of the things either side of the European Union, because yeah, you know, my thing is I'm not European. You know, I'm talking to you. I'm not talking to a Frenchman.
Right.
And so I feel great kinships with America. Plenty of shared culture and shared history there. Canada, Australia. My wife is Zimbabwean. I have friends in the West Indies. You know, it's this network. And I work with plenty of people from India. I used to live in Leicester, which is huge, a huge Indian population.
Really?
This is
Leicester, as in the reigning premiership champion, Leicester?
Indeed.
What? That's amazing. They're the most popular city in the world right now. Everybody loves Leicester until Jamie Vardy leaves them for $20 million, but yeah.
It is so surreal, this season. Because it's like, I am a football fan, but I was more into it about 5 years ago. I realized that football's got so about the team that there isn't the space for individual personalities, there once were. No, the best players are the best in very similar ways, because you have to be a certain person to be a great footballer. Whereas things like boxing and UFC or something like cricket, you do get the different types of people, you get the individual stories. It's not just 11 people being cogs in a machine. But everybody knows I'm a Leicester City fan. People say, are you happy? And it's just like, it's fucking Bermuda. It's just like the most bizarre, bewildering thing ever. It's like, just watching them lift the trophy, and it's just like,
I had to say, I'm sitting there watching this as a guy who supported Liverpool for probably 6 or 7 years now. I have not missed a single match, domestic or otherwise. And here I am seeing Leicester lift the trophy. I'm going, what is happening? What did Brendan Rodgers do that was so bad that Leicester City beat us to the punch? This is incredible. This isn't fair.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of... it's just bizarre. And I think if we play great football, and it was very odd because we played great football. We were very high scoring, free flowing. And then all of a sudden, our defense got awesome. And so my whole thing, I mean, don't even remember the season when Hull City came up and they just blitzed in us scoring all these goals. And then all of a sudden people worked out how to stop them scoring, but they were still shipping the same number of goals as they were before. And so then they just went on this massive losing streak and only just stayed up. And I was paranoid, thinking something was going to happen, and we were winning all these games, you know, 2-1, 3-2, 4-3, you know, 3-1, and at some point we stopped from scoring.
But you
and
didn't.
Then we struggled to win a game. But we didn't, because our goals dried up. But at that point, no one could score against us.
Yeah.
A local African bar in Leicester the day we played Man U, and I was just walking around before I was going to get my food, watch the game, and the whole area was just, you know, every bar was showing it, people in every bar, just absolutely crazy. And yeah, and it's great for the city, it's put the city on the map. I mean, do you remember when Andrew Winner first fought in the UFC? And Bruce Buffer, completely got the way to pronounce Leicester wrong. He's like, well, I'm from Leicester, England.
In Bruce's defense, there's a lot of towns and cities in England that are not spelled the way that they are pronounced. Worcester, Leicester. Like, I don't know what you guys have a problem with, like, different, consonants and how you get Leicester out of what should be Leicester or something like that, but there's something weird going on there.
The best one is where I'm from, which is Loughborough, which is near Leicester, and American. It's actually probably like Loughborough University's identity now. Is Americans, if they try and pronounce it, And is Luga Baruga.
What a fantastic language you guys have butchered.
But that's kind of where I see Britain. But to try and fit within what the European Union becomes, making it very difficult because it is creating this public pressure for really draconian immigration. But yeah.
No.
I'm getting a hook from my wife.
No, you're good. Loudly. Actually, I know we're getting along here. I just have to ask you. First of all, you do the plug for everything. You got a special magazine coming out soon. I'm aware of, but I have to ask one question about my favorite person from all of Britain right now. If I say the name, I hope it resonates. Otherwise, I'll be sad. Milo Yiannopoulos.
Milo Yiannopoulos?
Does he register in Britain at all, or is he only famous here in America?
Only famous here in America.
Oh! He's a very right-wing Briton who's incredibly outwardly gay, and he speaks to American universities all over the place. He is flamboyant. He calls Donald Trump Uncle Daddy. Like, he's just so fantastic. I've seen him on Sky TV here and there. But he's awesome. I just love him. Anyways, I didn't know if he was popular over there or not.
I'm going to have to Google him. like now. so plug. I can't talk about why the issue is super special because it's a secret.
Right.
But Mike helped out in a super secret project about to help celebrate UFC 200, which will be in the next issue of Fighting Spirit magazine. Fighting Spirit magazine is Britain's biggest and best pro wrestling, UFC, sometimes boxing, and I persuade my editor to include boxing, monthly newsstand magazine, full colour. Our latest issue is out, includes my feature on Conor McGregor, and I talk about how he got completely bitch slapped by the UFC after he tried to get Dana to give him more money. It's a great magazine. I can't remember if it was this issue or the last issue, had a fantastic Jim Cornette article on Balls Mahoney, which by the end of it, you know, he was almost having blubbing like a little baby, because it was just absolutely amazing. So yeah, fighting, I mean, it's obviously, if you're not in Britain, you can walk into a newsagent and get it. If you're outside of Britain, it's available on the Fighting Spirit magazine app.
Is there any Twitter, Facebook, anything else to plug?
My Twitter is at Will Cooling, and I also write for a website that can't be named on here. Begins with W.
Yes, you kid, you can name it. I'm fine with it. I don't mind.
I also write for WrestlingObserver.com. I've written for a while. My last one was about the brand split. And all my great ideas, which is weird because I didn't write that off that long ago, but it was completely before Brock Lesnar came back to the UFC and the whole world changed. So,
well, again, I know you've got to get going. It's like, I don't know, 2 or 3 in the morning for you right now. I really appreciate you doing this. I think that this was fascinating. I'm glad that I got to speak with someone that was actually genuinely intelligent. It balances out my stupidity. Will, again, thank you so much. Everybody listening, we'll catch you again soon. Until next time, this is the Half Guarded Hour at halfguarded.com. We'll have links to all of Will's stuff on the post, which will be up probably tomorrow, assuming I don't have a bad hangover. Until then, everybody, we'll talk to you guys later.
Aggressively, we all defend the role we play. Regrettably, times come to send you on your way. We've seen it all, bonfires of trust, flash floods of pain. It doesn't really matter, don't you worry, it'll all work out. No, it doesn't even matter, don't you worry, that ain't what it's all about. We hope you enjoy your
for the day.